Well, good afternoon and welcome to the late afternoon session. I'm Dennis Rooney, moderator, and I won't waste any time since we're already a little past our scheduled start to introduce the first speakers and their subject. As the recording by radio networks became more common after 1935 due to the advent of 16-inch acetate lacquer-coated aluminum discs, it became possible to preserve some of the remarkable music being broadcast on radio in those years. And Swedish tenor Jussi Björling made his American debut via radio in 1937 at age 26 in three successive Sunday night programs broadcast nationally from Carnegie Hall. Those were recorded, but the copies we have are hard to listen to due to much wear over many years. One of those concerts was saved by a Swedish-American collector who passed his copy along to Swedish radio. The American chapter of the Jussi Björling Society has cooperated with the Björling Museum in Sweden, the Björling family, and collectors to obtain good copies of about 20 programs in high-quality radio material from 1937 to 1960, featuring the tenor with the Bell Telephone Hour, the Voice of Firestone, the Standard Hour, etc. These have been processed and transferred to CD by Seth Winner for release on September 9th of this year, which will mark the 50th anniversary of Jussi Björling's death. Seth will describe some of the technical problems involved and play excerpts from that nearly final project. By the way, if you're interested in further investigation of sound clips and information, go to www.jussibjorlingsociety.org. Dan Shea is retired from the University of Wisconsin in Madison, where he was professor of mathematics for 40 years, working in harmonic analysis or Fourier analysis, a field that he notes has provided much of the theoretical underpinning of the technical devices used to improve the sound of historic recordings. He has been a fan of historical singers since childhood, tracing his interest in Jussi Björling back to 1950 when he was 12. He also liked another tenor who was then all the rage at the same time, Mario Lanza. With several others, Professor Shea founded the American chapter of the Jussi Björling Society in 1997. Conferences have been subsequently held in Washington, D.C. in 1999, New York, 2002, Los Angeles, 2005, Minneapolis, 2006, and Charleston, South Carolina, 2009, in addition to one in Stockholm in 2004. The Society also conducts research on Björling and his era, publishes a journal and newsletters, and encourages the publication of books and CDs about Björling and his legacy. The Björling Society frequently cooperates with sister chapters in the UK and in Scandinavia, and with other organizations like the Leonard Warren Foundation and Bruce Burroughs' Zinka Milanoff Biography Project. Seth B. Winner has been president of Seth B. Winner Sound Studios since its inception in 1990. His studio has done remastering projects for such associations as the New York Philharmonic, Minnesota Orchestra, the Metropolitan Opera, Sony BMG, Pavilion Records, Crystal, and Stash Records. As a result, he's been awarded three Grammy nominations and one honorable mention from NARIS. From 1996 to 2004, he was co-chair of ARSC's technical committee with Gary Galo, as well as a contributor to the CLIR technical report concerning analog identification, conservation, and preservation. In addition, he's been a sound engineer at the New York Public Library for over 20 years. In that capacity, he has been the preservation engineer of various sound collections that belonged to the National Orchestral Association, the Little Orchestra Society, Roberta Peters, Henry Cowell, Vincent Persichetti, the Voice of America, Otto Luening, and U.B. Blake. He has also been the technical conservator of the famed Toscanini Collection since 1988. Recently, he has done or is in the process of preserving and or remastering collections of the Cy Walter Archives, the Bach Aria Group, Mark Laycock's performances with the Princeton Symphony Orchestra, the Schnabel Family Foundation, and the Benny Carter and Benny Goodman collections housed at the Institute of Jazz Studies, Rutgers University, of which a paper was presented earlier today. Since 1995, he and Mr. Galo have formed a subcommittee to locate the best pastrami sandwich in the metropolitan New York City area since the demise of their favorite deli in Brooklyn in 1995. An update has come in since this morning. When Mr. Galo visits New York City in July, he and Seth will visit a couple of establishments in Brooklyn and Queens to determine who serves the best in Jewish cuisine. Stay tuned. Welcome, please, these gentlemen and their presentation on Yossi Bierlin.
Well, thanks very much, Dennis. I realized while listening to that, which was written several weeks ago, that some of the significance of those dates that you mentioned is which I'd always taken for granted, the Metropolitan Opera debut of Bierlin in 1938, the nationwide national broadcast radio programs from Carnegie Hall in 1937, the advent of recording of radio programs in starting around 1935, all those things recently, because of things I've learned from Seth as we've worked together, has become much more significant. So I'm listening with different ears than I wrote with originally. Let me just emphasize a few things. Bierlin was born in 1911. Already in 1937, he was making his first his debut in America as a tenor, and he'd had it arranged for him that he'd be singing in these three consecutive Sunday nights on what was called then the General Motors Concert Hour. A heck of an introduction, not by the usual institutions like the Met, but by radio. And it led to some great publicity for a concert tour that he was about to undertake. So, for instance, between the first radio concert that he gave and the second one, which was a week later, he actually gave a concert in Springfield, Massachusetts, which is his American concert debut is in the flesh. That's my hometown, and I looked up the review, which was on the front page of the Springfield Union in 1937. The concert was December 1st. The review is December 2nd. I've got copies for everybody here on the table. Anybody who's interested, please feel free to pick up information about the Bierlin Society, that review, or a few copies of the journal that we publish once a year, along with newsletters. The review started off by saying that to one who heard Bierlin on the air Sunday night and who has heard his recordings, the realization that this Bierlin in the flesh was a pure lyric tenor came as something of a surprise. Bierlin is at the moment a magnificent lyric tenor, and it goes on to talk about the ring and brilliant quality to the top voice, which, of course, we all associate with Bierlin. The reviewer goes on to talk about how Bierlin can spin a tone indefinitely or hurl it to the furthermost part of the building. This was in a very large auditorium. The Springfield Municipal Auditorium seats pretty close to 4,000 people, and this lyric tenor was making quite an impression. Well, although this 1937 series of concerts was Bierlin's debut to America, it had been arranged a few months earlier for Bierlin to record a message to the American people addressed to Milton Cross, who was going to be the host of this series of concerts, and We found that message in the Björling Museum in Sweden, and Seth has copied it. And you can all listen to this 26-year-old talk about the upcoming visit to America.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm delighted, Mr. Gross, to have the opportunity to send you a greeting from Stockholm. And I'm looking forward to the end of November, then I will come to America. As a little boy, I have been in the United States, and I'm very glad to come back again. And I hope you will be satisfied with me and my song. Good night, everybody.
Well, that was that, and we're not sure how widely it was actually used, but it was a good early attempt at making publicity. You all know how, starting at about that time, recordings were made on acetate lacquer discs, and you know what happened to a lot of those lacquer discs. The more interesting they were, the less likely they were to end up being in good shape after a few years. They were played and played and played with blunt needles. They were delicate themselves to start with. They didn't have that many plays. And so of the three radio concerts, the first and third are very difficult to listen to and get much enjoyment from. But we're very lucky that the second concert was an early copy of it, was saved by a Swedish-American collector who at a certain early point sent over his copy to Swedish radio, and they maintained it and then passed it along to the Björling Museum. And eventually it fell into our hands with the blessings of the Björling family. And Seth is engaged in putting that on our series of four CDs that will be coming out. It's going to be quite a job, but Seth is going to do great things with it. I'd just like to say that this material we have is in the first place very good sources. We consider these are the best sources that we've been able to collect over the last 10 years of our existence, and we've had a lot of help from collectors around the world, particularly with the Björling family collection, which was very useful, and then the Björling Museum. Besides having really good sources, of course, you really need to have a top sound engineer to work with.
Where is he?
We settled for Seth.
Thank you.
Actually, I'd just like to say that we are thrilled to have Seth as our engineer. We think that no one would do better, and we are quite convinced of that. And along with his ability comes a long time particular affinity and interest in UC Björling. So in particular, he's been able to contribute some of our best sources himself from his own collection. So thanks a lot, Seth.
Thank you, Dan.
Just to start, just one comment. We'll start with one of my favorite items. We thought we'd give you a sample of some of the things that are on this new collection. And one of my favorite things is a KJ Lita Menina from La Boheme, one of Björling's favorite arias. This particular one, this is from a Standard Hour, Standard Oil of California, broadcast from 1949. It's a concert with the Merula, Gaetano Merula conducting, and his wife, Annalisa, is there with him and some of the items. So this is just Yussi. He, along the way, he builds up to a high C, which seems to delight him so much that it's a real high C, unlike a lot of times in live performance. A tenor is quite entitled to drop it a half tone to a B. He gets that high C, and he just hangs on to it because he enjoys it so much. You can tell when he lets loose that this is a good night.
Okay. Now it's my turn. That was Dan's favorite recording. My favorite comes from a standard hour done on September 30th, 1951. The Tosti song La Bossa Sapara. And if you read the biography about Buehrling, he heard Caruso's recording in 1949 and fell in love with it, and wherever he went, he sang it. Well, Roger Pines, who wrote the notes for this, kind of agrees with me, saying this is probably his best performance of it. And it's also an evening where, in a sense, you're going to hear what's called the Buehrling legend, which I always call that he's spinning gold. He can do no wrong. Notice it's the same voice, but how he changes the coloring of it from one piece to the next. Now we're going to have a little fun. You know, pardon me?
Sugar sing?
Oh, George, that isn't fun. That's torture. Keep that in mind. Differentiate it. Those of you who are familiar with collecting the Buehrling discography probably have realized that he is probably the most maligned in the sense of sound on pirate issues. Eddie Smith was the first to do some of his stuff. Legendary was another. MDP was another. And I'm going to focus in on something. Here is the beginning of a rather unusual broadcast from April 11th, 1949, in Carnegie Hall, broadcast over in WNYC. It was for the Siemens Fund, the Swedish Siemens Fund. And Buehrling opened the second half of the concert. To most of us, this is the way it sounded coming off an MDP LP from about 20-odd years ago.
I just sing you a Swedish song, The Maiden Under the Linden Tree, by Wilhelm Pettersson Berger.
Thought that was mine. Bite your tongue.
It sounded pretty good to me, actually.
Well, if you listen carefully.
Behind the speakers.
Yeah, right, but behind the speakers.
Ah,
okay.
That sounds like, they claimed it was off a paper tape. It also sounds like everything in that set sounded like it was run through some sort of compressor, as you can hear. It's very woolly and opaque. We fortunately located a collector in Sweden who had a set of Rock Hill 78 RPM lacquers that were dubbed from a set of 16 inches. I could hear the original surface under it, but it was definitely either taken off the line from NYC or from a very good FM tuner. As a result, this is what's coming out. It is not perfect, but I think it's a far cry better than what you just heard.
The audience will have its way, and once again, Jussi Björling.
Yes, you're right.
The Maiden from the Divided Tree by Wilhelm Petersson Berg.
Like I said, he spins gold. That was a second encore that held up the concert that it ran over 2 hours as a result of him singing four songs in these two encores. Now we're going to have fun with something else. How many of you remember EJS? Raise your hands. Come on, Steve. Come on, Mike.
Paul, yes. Yeah, oh, Gary, yes, and Al, yeah.
What I'm going to play for you is what everybody thought is the best sound source to the only time the two of them ever appeared together on the radio, of Eleanor Stieber and Björling doing the Miserere from Trovatore. This is what Eddie Smith put out on EJS 367. Get ready.
Thank you.
Steve, you were nodding your head. You picked up on it. And it's also sharp, besides all those noises in there. When I heard it, I said, I didn't know that, Lionel Mapleson was recording Beerling and Stieber at the time. Maybe we have an undiscovered Mapleson cylinder here. And this is, you should have seen the condition of this record. I had to run through a passive deep click to even get it to that point. Well, we get in the new source, and I said, oh, great, I'm going to finally hear it. This is what we got. As all of you know what that is, yes, it may be January of 1946, but there was still glass-based discs kicking around from World War II, and that was one that was cracked from the center out. Well, yours truly said, well, roll up my sleeves, lock the door in the studio, and thanks to Frank over there with Sadie, after running it through the Cedar Cambridge system, I had to manually remove each one of those clicks and do a dethump and then use retouch in order to repair that crack. There was also a For You Alone on that side. So between the two items, there was about 8 minutes of material with 33 and a third cracks per minute. Do the math of how long I was working on this confounded thing. And then after I'd done it, I played it back a day later, so I said, because I can't stand it anymore. You know, you just can't do it after a certain point. And double-checked and made sure I didn't create any artifacts within the voice when doing that. And I did catch a couple where I had to undo it and then try with retouch. And as a result, this is what's going to come out on the CD. For Seth. Thank you. But I got to also thank Frank over there, who is a representative of Prism. I've been using the Sadie products now for the last 15 years. Frank has gotten a few gray hairs and lost some as a result, dealing with me, but what else is new? We're going to conclude now with the only thing so far that actually came from tape. It was something when Dan and I were going through, a friend of mine had handed me a tape, and it is an air check of the famous Producers Showcase program from January 30 of 1956 with Renato Tabaldi, where they did three excerpts from La Boheme on television. It was what the first, I think, color Producers Showcase done on NBC. And when he heard the sound of this, he was so taken by it, he said, we have to put it in. Do you want to add anything to that?
I'd like to say that we have a hard time in the Burling Society deciding when he was at his peak. Was it 1937? Was it 1941? Was it fresh back from the Second World War, after the Second World War? You know, was it at the very end? This is 4 years from the end, and if I had to guess, I'd say that the way he sounds here is my idea of Burling at its greatest, but yeah, who knows?
And just to let you know, this was taken off of some sort of FM tuner that could pull up the FM sidebands at the time off of the local station. And this was another one dealing with dropouts. There was a ground loop hum in it, as well as some sort of buzz running through it. And through retouch, I was able to come up with something that sounds like this. Thank you. I just want to mention that recording also was a horror in the sense that they kept jacking the level up as it went along. And that took another evening of a staple chase of just bringing everything down and re-leveling it. as Dan had said to me one time, you know, he's a professor of math, has given a number of papers and worked on a number of projects, but he said to him his lifelong dream has been accomplished. This is something he really has looking forward to and feels like it's the most satisfying thing he has done in his whole career. And I take my hat off to you for this, for the organization, and what have you done, and what you have done.
It's taken a lot of work, but to write 50 math papers along the way is what you did for your bread and butter. But since I was 12, I'd somehow wanted to do something for UC Burling. I think the UC Burling Society, together with, you know, in Sweden they have this wonderful museum that you should all visit. John Steen has said it's the best of all singers museums in the world. What could be better? I mean, you know, if you're a singer and you want to be remembered, this kind of recognition from a museum is quite wonderful. Singers don't usually, you know, it's a ephemeral art, really, in many ways, particularly, you know, before recordings. But I have to say, I just put in a word here, American singers can't, you know, if you had a museum like Burling has, we'd be accused of socialism. One American singer I know, Leonard Warren, has been the Leonard Warren Foundation, and they've done some great work. And I'd like to recognize, after 25 years of with many accomplishments, I'd like to say thank you to Barry Crawford for his great work for Leonard Warren.
Well, I want to thank you all. 3 minutes. Anybody have a question or two? Yes, Mike.
I'm confused about the message to NBC that he's sending that to.
Yeah, that was supposed to go over. Yeah, that was like a publicity message.
That would, you don't know what kind of use it would have, how much circulation it would have had. The network would not have played it. The network would not play any recording. So. The most that would have happened is Milton Cross would have said, "We got a message from," and
could be,
read it out. The network would not play it.
Mm-hmm. Apparently, it was played a couple of occasions, but maybe they weren't. But they were nothing like nothing from a broad. Yeah, maybe not on the broadcast. Yeah.
So, yes, yeah, John, yeah.
Seth, are there any recordings of him in normal conversation?
Oh, there's a ton of them. They're about. Right,
Whole CD.
CD's worth of, you know, interviews, starting from about as early as 53 to about 59, and then there was one.
Is he performing or is it normal conversation?
It's kind of normal conversation. Some of it's really boring. I mean, the interviewers are just like, "Oh, Mr. Burling, listen, what are you up to?" And it's like he's trying to find words. Like one of them, that awful one from NYC, and it's 1959. "Well, what are some of your other favorite tenors at the Met?" And he's like kind of fumbling. "Well, there's Richard Tucker, there's Carlo Burgonzi, who had just made, you know, was coming into his own." I was saying, "Oh, he's very good." It's kind of, you know, you listen through it. He talks about possible recordings. One of them was supposed to have been a Verdi Requiem with Beecham, which never happened.
Although it eventually became Fritz Reiner, you know, but
right.
So there was a requiem coming, but it was going to be with Tibaldi, and it ended up with Leontine Price. Yeah. So.
But anyway, one last, and then we got to yes.
Are you going to include production notes on this?
In the sense of what? You mean what I did to the? Oh yeah, there'll be an engineer's note in there. Don't worry about that. The asylum of 2055 Whalen Avenue in Long Island, right? All right, thank you, ladies and gentlemen. If any questions afterwards, we'll be able to talk to you. Thank you.
Thanks to Dan and Seth, and also to UC Burling, for those of us who needed a definitive pronunciation of Wilhelm Petersen Berger, in case you weren't wondering.